My name's Gary Miller, and I'm an alcoholic. Really glad to be here. Thank you so much for Jim for contacting me and asking me to share. I'm going to share a great deal on the rewards of recovery. I think most of us, if we're here, we know how to drink. I will qualify a little. I was born and raised in a small town in northwestern Ohio in a very strong Christian conservative family. There was no drinking, so I can't blame my parents. If I wanted to blame my mother, I could blame her for maybe putting me on the pot backwards to pee when I was a kid or something. I don't know, but my alcoholism is my own. It's not somebody else's. I did not really drink in high school or college. And there were some real reasons for that. But then when I got out of college, I taught school one year, didn't like that job, went back to school, became an engineer, worked in industry, got a pretty good job. But I started drinking right after I got out of school. And I'll never forget, it wasn't very long that a bar that I drank at, they went and took a can of spray paint and spray painted my name on the parking bumper. And I was like, in Bill's story, I thought I had arrived. I thought I'd really made the deal. I have lost a job drinking. I have lost a family drinking. I have lost, I've just lost my life basically drinking. And I did some really crazy things. I'll mention this. When I drink, I lie. And I worked for a Fortune 500 company and moved up quickly and was actually on the corporate staff and was down in Texas and was drinking in a bar. And there was some talk about happy hour. And I said to the guys, I said, look, there's the best place for happy hour is a Boxer's Bar in Sunbury, Pennsylvania. And if you want to go there, meet me tomorrow night at Love Field. And I got a jet sitting out there, and we'll fly up there tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock. We'll fly up there and do happy hour. And that's exactly what we did. There was about four guys that said, okay, I'll go. And we went up there and I did not get fired for that. And the reason is that I justify all of my behaviors. And we had a plant in Selinsgrove, Grove, Pennsylvania. And I told folks that I had to go up there because they had an emergency. And I went up there to take care of that and then turn around and flew back. I actually got fired I didn't have a problem going to work on Monday. I had problems going to work after lunch. And that was an issue that got going. And I was talked to about my drinking. And if I would have accepted and stopped drinking then, I'd have 60 years of sobriety today. I do have a sobriety date. My sobriety date is October 6th of 1986. I have a sponsor. I've had three sponsors that have passed away, and I've talked a great deal about my first sponsor, but I'm going to talk about when it was I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I had been going to see a therapist on Monday afternoons at 5 o'clock because my wife wasn't doing right. She had accused me of being an alcoholic and it pissed me off. And so I did what I do even today. If you accuse me of something I'm guilty of, I'll react and respond negatively. And so I picked up the phone and I dialed, it was at 10 o'clock at night. I dialed a number 388-0600. And that's a treatment center in South Mississippi. And I don't know where I got that number. They have no idea how I got it or where I got it. Anyway, I wound up going and seeing this therapist and that was in February. And it wasn't until October that I got sober. And so during that course of time, I tried to quit drinking numerous times and actually went through hallucinations. Did all kinds of things to try to quit drinking. It was just really a terrible, terrible time. Don't know why, but on the 3rd of October, I stopped in a bar, and I hadn't drank in a bar probably in 10 years because I always drank at home, I was a great drink and drive, and I had my own spiritual spot was out along a river that I used to go to, and I'd sit there and lament and so on. But anyway, I went to this bar. It was on a Friday, and went to the bar and started drinking. And I'm a classy drinker. I was drinking with the mayor and a local DJ, and of course went into. I was only about 5 miles from the house. But I stayed the night in that at that bar. There was a motel next to it, and I went and stayed the night in that motel. The next morning, got up and drank all day. Then I went to my spiritual spot out along the river, stayed there, and decided on Sunday I was going to commit suicide. So I knew that the house would be empty, and so I went to the house, got a 12-gauge shotgun, put a deer slug in it, went out there and hid my truck, and practice committing suicide. And I just knew y'all were going to really miss me, and everybody was going to feel bad. You know, it's amazing to me. I was going to commit suicide and then live happily ever after. And so anyway, then all of a sudden it occurred to me, well, gosh, I won't be to my appointment on Monday evening afternoon at 5 o'clock with that therapist. So I better call her and tell her I wouldn't be there. So anyway, she didn't work on Sunday. So that's, I called her Monday morning. I went down and called her. It's amazing what God does. I believe that God wants me sober. Where I called her from, there was it was an old grocery store that had a fire. And on the side of the store, there was a phone booth or a phone attached to the wall. And I called from that phone, and, after I got sober and went back there, that was all gone. It was tore down and the phone was gone. So I think that phone was there just for me to make that call. But I called her, and I'm sobbing and crying and snotting and carrying on, and said, I won't be there. She said, well, why? And I said, well, I'm going to commit suicide. And she said, well, where are you? And I said, well, I'm not going to tell you. And she said, well, you do me one favor before you die. And I said, well, okay. I'll try if I can. And she said, well, since I can't come and see you, because I've been learned to care for you and love you, and I can't come and see you and tell you goodbye, will you come to me and just come to my office, and then you can, after I tell you goodbye, then you can go commit suicide. And I said, well, okay. Now, I had to drive about 20 miles, so I put that 12-gauge shotgun on my truck, and over there I went. I left there 35 days later, so be careful if you want me to tell you goodbye, because I'm liable to hang around a while. But I went to treatment, and I was in treatment for 28 days, and I really was, I thought I was the star of the treatment center. And my 28th day, they called me in and said, we'd like you to stay one more week. And I said, well, okay. I thought they wanted me to stay because I was such help to the newcomer coming in. But what they did that day is they did an in-house intervention on me. And man, you talk about being pissed off. I mean to tell you, I wanted, homicide was on my mind. They brought up all kinds of stuff, the basic, that for 28 days I've been sitting there shooting the breeze and lying to them and so on. And so I was really confronted with that. So I left there after that 28 days. My truck was still in the parking lot. The only thing that was different was that the gun was gone. I have that gun today. I keep it as a memento to remind me of that. And but anyway, I went to the house, and my key didn't work. I couldn't get in. So I was so then I went to a motel and got a motel. And 2 days later, I was locked out of the motel because my credit card wasn't any good. So I was really in a pickle. And I got out of treatment the 11th of November. By Thanksgiving, I got a letter from the government telling me that there was a warrant for me for failure to pay fiduciary taxes. Because what had happened after I got fired, I couldn't get a job. Because the type of job I was looking for, they always did backgrounds on you. And evidently my alcohol abuse had shown up. And so I couldn't get a job. So I started my own business. And I retired from that business. And obviously it was a success, but at first it was not. And I had employees and I had fiduciary taxes, and I would fill out the coupons. I just wouldn't make the deposit in the bank. And that scared me to death the first couple months. But then I found out, well, you know, that they're not here, so everything's going to be all right. And I'll figure out a way someday. I'll go ahead and make those payments. Well, I didn't. And, you know, it's amazing. Again, I think that God said, that guy thinks he's pretty whippy, snippy, smart. So let's just call the IRS and tell him to come down on him. And they did. And I got my letter from him before Thanksgiving, the 10th of December. The state of Mississippi, I was in Mississippi at the time, and the state of Mississippi came in and put a lien on everything I had because I hadn't paid my taxes there either. So now I'm really in a pickle. And every time I'd go to, you know, I had to work on a cash basis, and it was terrible. And so then I was worried that they were going to arrest me. So what I did is I started going to AA meetings, because I argued with my aftercare counselor that I could only do 3 AA meetings a week. I said, I'm just way, way too busy. Well, guess what? That scared the living poo out of me. And I didn't think they'd come and arrest you at an AA meeting. So I started going to AA. And I went, and it's amazing, at 24th Avenue in Gulfport, Mississippi, they started in November of 86. They started a noon meeting, and they started a 5:15 meeting. And again, I think that that was God working in my life. Because I went to the noon meeting and went to the 5:15 meeting, and then I'd go to an 8 o'clock meeting in the evening. And there I thought, well, that's when they're going to get me. And so I wouldn't go to the same meeting. I'd go all over. I went from Slidell, Louisiana to Pascagoula, Mississippi, to Hattiesburg, Mississippi, in that whole section. I went to meetings, different meeting every night, never went the same one for probably 4 or 5 months. I went to 3 meetings a day for a long time. And I still sometimes today go to 3 meetings a day. It's because I'm retired. But anyway, I just went all over the place. Little did I know that was preparing me for what God had in mind for my life later on in recovery. And so then I had to get a sponsor, because I thought they told me that if I didn't get a sponsor, I'd get thrown out of AA. That's what I heard. It's not what they said, but that's what I heard. So I got a sponsor, and my first sponsor, actually God picked him. I didn't. Tom was retired military. I'm not retired military, never been in the military. Anyway, I went to him, and he said, you pick a time. He said, I'm retired. You pick a time, and I'm going to commit. If you'll commit to me, I'll commit to you 1 hour every week, guaranteed. And the time was 3 o'clock Friday afternoon. And he said, if you're late, don't worry about it. Just keep on coming, because don't call, because there's no sense in calling, because it's your time, and I won't take a telephone call during your time. And so what I heard him say is, you better have your butt at my house at 3 o'clock Friday afternoon. And that's when I got there, and he said, he was 13 years sober at that time. And he said, we're going to start in the big book. And we did. And of course, the same old deal. We opened up the first page and noticed it was blank on the left-hand side. And he said, that's the start. And I tried to convince him that since I'd been in treatment that, we've been through the first 3 steps, and he said, no, we're going to go into Alcoholics Anonymous. And we did that. And so I went through the book with Tom. The other thing I failed to mention earlier is that at a very early age, because of my behaviors, I was excommunicated from a Protestant church. And because of that and so on, my parents actually disinherited me and shunned me. And for 4 years, I didn't see any member of my family. And that was pretty, at the time, that was a good reason to drink. Because I'd go to a bar and I'd just tell you how poorly I was treated. And I rode that horse till the bones evaporated on. I just rode that forever. So anyway, then I get to Tom, and Tom says, you know, he does things like If you go to meetings, and I was, his home group was on Wednesday night, and I used to go to his home group, and I sat next to him, and he always was there early and set the meeting up. And he had started that meeting, and so I'd always go sit there next to him. And one night, I'll never forget, I went in I was sitting next to him, and nobody was there yet, and there was a thermos of coffee sitting next to him. And I said, "Oh, did Francis fix you some special coffee?" And he said, "No, I fixed that." He said, "That's for you." And I was, boy, my head swelled up. I thought, that's pretty great. I don't know how many of y'all have ever had your sponsor bring you coffee at a meeting, but I was really uptight about it. He said, "Well," he said, "the reason is because if you'll notice that," he said, "has anybody ever said anything at an AA meeting that really meant something to you?" And I said, "Well, yeah." And I mentioned something that was said. He said, "Have you ever heard anybody else repeat that?" And I said, "No." I said, "I really haven't." He said, "Well, that was God speaking to you. And what if the person next to you got up right at that time and you wouldn't have heard it?" And he said, "You see, when you get up and go get coffee, or you get up and go to the bathroom, or you get up and walk outside," because his home group was at a church. He said, "You get up and go out and smoke a cigarette," because I smoked at that time. He said, "You might interrupt the person next to you." And he said, "One of the things we don't want to do is we don't want to mess up people next to us. We don't want to interfere in their sobriety." I can assure you that from that point on, I have never smoked at an AA meeting. I have never, after that, I never got up. I used to check to see if I could go to the bathroom before I went to the meeting started. The same thing with coffee. I never got up and got coffee. I would, if I was shy on nicotine or on coffee, I'd just get two cups and set it down in front of me. I never forgot that. I don't forget that today. If I go to a meeting today, if I got an issue and I get up, I need to get up, I think about Tom, about how he treated me or told me about that. And then I got into service. I got a home group. And I got into service because I was asked, I was appointed alternate GSR. I wasn't even at the business meeting, but I was appointed alternate GSR. I was sober about a year, year and a half. And the guy that was GSR, he's still sober today. We talk about it when I see him. He went to the first district meeting and he came back and said, "That's it. I'm not going to that bunch. That's a bunch of politics. I'm not going to go to that stuff no more." And so then I became the GSR, and that started my service work. And Tom bought me my first service manual. I still have it. And he said, that tells you what you need to do and how to do it. And anyway, so I started there and I proceeded on and got into the area and did some service work in the area. And I still to this day will drive to Mississippi to go to area assembly. It's just because I've been there I didn't miss area assembly for probably 25 years. I never missed an area assembly. I was there all the time, every time. You probably could count on both hands up until the pandemic the times that I have missed area assembly. It's just a thing that I have. I think if you're into that kind of service work, you ought to be there and you ought to take care of it. So anyway, I do that. But I'm going to tell you about some other wonderful things, some rewards. In my office, I didn't want anybody to know I was an alcoholic. So I took the truck that I drove. I took the signs off the side of it. I had the business signs on, and that's the one I drove to AA meetings. I had other trucks, but I just the one that I drove, I took the signs off of. I used to park behind the meeting houses. I didn't want people to know that I was an AA. Obviously, everybody soon became very much aware of the fact that I was an AA. But I had a guy come to my office one day because I was doing some work. I was fortunate. I got a very good contract with the telephone company. I built and maintained their buildings in the southern half of Mississippi. And though I didn't want them to know, and I had to go through a security thing for that to get it. And I was so afraid they were going to find out that I was an AA and I was an alcoholic. Amazingly, the facility manager that helped me get that contract, his brother was an AA. And he also had a brother that died due to alcoholism. So it actually was helped me get that contract. The next facility manager that took over and took his position, they had a family member that was sober in AA for an extended period of time. So that never hurt me at all. Anyway, I was doing a project, and I had a guy come into my office to tell him what the needs were. And I've never been very anonymous. I've always had a big book or something laying on my desk. And this guy came in and he said, I haven't seen one of those in a long time. And I said, are you in recovery? And he said, well, yeah, no, kind of, sort of. He said, a couple of years ago, I went to treatment. And he said, I've stayed sober through the church. And he said, we take a meeting into the state penitentiary once a month, a church meeting up there. And he said, there's some guys up there that have been asking for an AA meeting. Would you be willing to go up there? And that was in the fall of 1991. And I said, well, I'll get back with you. And so when he left, I called Tom. I said, I told him about it. And he said, I said, what should I tell him? He said, call him back, see if we can go tomorrow. So anyway, that started the deal, where in February of 1992, we got certified and went into the state penitentiary. The last time I was in the state penitentiary, and now, of course, unfortunately, because of age, I can't walk in there. It's a pretty good way. But the last time I was in there was last November. I went in there last November, and I did make it. I said, I'll make it in there. And they said, if you'll come back, we'll bring a wheelchair out and wheel you in. And my ego won't let that happen yet, but it made it at some point. I have been at every one of the state penitentiaries in the state of Mississippi. We went there for 7 years, never missed a Thursday night. Every Thursday night we were there and carried. And now we found out it didn't work to take a discussion meeting in there, because what we'd hear how unfortunate they were, and it was never their fault. So we took a book study meeting in there, and really got intense in book study meeting. And then it's the first time that we were talking about doing the third step. And one of the guys said something about, well, how do you do a third step? And we said, well, we get on our knees and hold hands and do the third step prayer. And so that's the first time I ever have done that with a group. And we did it consistently there at that penitentiary in Leakesville. By the way, that penitentiary was, from my house to that penitentiary, was 97 miles one way. And I was broke. I have no idea where I ever got the money to get the gas to go there every week, but I did it every week. I have no idea. Nobody ever paid me. And I always complained to Tom about money. I kept saying, you know, because I owed the government a lot of money, and I didn't know how I was ever going to get out of it. And I'll never forget one day. Today, very honestly, I'll be happy to tell you, I have more money than I need, and I carry it in my truck. So if anybody ever needs it, if you see me, just tell me and I'll give it to you, because I'll never spend it. And Tom gave me that issue. One day I was over at his house and said something about money. And he said, this money thing is really going to hurt you, really hurting you. And I said, yeah, it really is. It's really bothered me. He said, well, and I thought he was going to write me a check. But anyway, he on the counter in his kitchen where I always sat, there was some change, and he reached up at that change and he slid down two pennies and two nickels. And he said, here, go put these in your truck, and everywhere you go, don't ever spend it. And everywhere you go, you will always be worth 2 cents. And if you think you're broke, you can take those out and jingle them in your hand and you'll have extra money, and always offer to give it away. I can assure you that even today, in every vehicle I own, there is 12 cents. I even, at one time in my business, I owned a dump truck, and in that dump truck, there was 12 cents in that dump truck. And I just, when I did, I'd always look to see if anybody took it. And sometimes people would, you know, somebody had taken it. And so I'd just replace it. And it's still true to me today. I think about that on a regular basis. Somehow or another, I've always had what my needs have always been met. Anyway, so we kept on to that penitentiary. And I'll tell you one other story about that. In 1994, inmate came to me and said, I'd like to do a fifth step. And it was they were very careful in doing their fourth step, because if you're in an institution like that, you don't have any privacy and they'll take stuff from you. So they did four steps by putting just one word or two words or whatever to remind them. So anyway, he said, I'd like to have you take my fifth step. Will you do it? And so I talked to the administration and they said, well, yeah, you can come up. You got to be here 8 o'clock on Sunday morning and we'll give you until 3:30. And at 3:30, you'll have to leave. And so I said, okay, fine. Now the wrinkle there was that inmate didn't know, he did not know where I lived. And he really didn't know much about me other than the fact that I was bringing a meeting up there. I knew where he was from. I knew what he had done. I knew why he was there. As a result of his crime, he and another fella, my neighbor, lost her life. She was 17 years old, and I knew that. I get emotional. Huh? I knew that family and knew them real well. And they had a lot of alcoholism in that family. So I went to Tom and I said, I don't know if I can, what do you think? I'm not sure I can do that. He said, reading the book, you can go anywhere, do anything if you're spiritually prepared. So in April of 1994, I went up there and took that man's fifth step. We spent most of our time on our knees on the floor. But he got off of his chest some things that, because he had turned state's evidence so that he didn't get his partner in crime is on Mississippi death row right now. But he got it. He didn't get the death sentence. So he got a big deal. And he said, well, how am I going to take care of that? He thought about writing the family a letter. And I said, you know, I really don't know. I said, let's pray about that. Because I said, you know, there's a lot of anger there. And I knew that the neighbors, there were four boys and four girls over there. And I knew them real well. And I knew about that crime. And they wanted to, they even talked about getting, they didn't know I was going to the penitentiary, number one. They knew I was an AA, but they didn't know I was going to penitentiary. There's more stories behind that. But they talked about somebody doing a crime that would get him in the penitentiary, and could they possibly get up there because they wanted to kill him. And anyway, so what we did is he wrote the victim a letter. And it was set up that on a Sunday evening, I would go over to the location of the crime. I knew where it was. And I would read that letter and burn it, and he would pray about it at the penitentiary. And we did that. And now I'm going to talk about those neighbor kids. They all knew I was an AA, and they used to, they used to borrow stuff from me because I had equipment that they wanted or could use, and they would borrow stuff from him. And periodically they'd make a joke about the fact we could. And they drank all the time. They were heavy, heavy drinkers. In fact, all four of the boys are dead today because of alcoholism. One of them shot himself on a Thursday night because I was at the penitentiary and I came home and there was a message on my answer machine to call the neighbors. Well, I didn't get home. And it was almost 11 o'clock when I got home. I thought, well, I'll call them in the morning. And anyway, they saw my light on and they called me to tell me that Johnny had shot himself. And Another one hung himself. He hung himself on the side of a 28-foot van truck. It was on Christmas night, and he had a noose, and he was drunk and went over to that rental place and was evidently sitting on the side, on the step of that truck. And he tied that noose up around the mirror. And when they found him, his butt was like 2 inches from the ground, but he had evidently passed out and slid off of that thing and it hung himself there. Another one died in the back of a police car. He was drunk. And I saw him run through my yard that day. And he was good and drunk and ran through, and he was going down the road. And anyway, he got arrested, and his, I guess his heart exploded or whatever, something happened. And he died in the back of a police car on the way to jail. And then Danny's the fourth one. He was my special guy. He used to come over. He knew I went to AA, and I used to, he got arrested, and he went to prison, and he went to the treatment center at prison. And so when he came home, he would want to go to AA meetings, and he didn't have a driver's license. And I used to go and pick him up. And I told him, I said, I'll pick you up anytime to take you to meeting. He knew my schedule. I went to meeting every day, and he knew my schedule. I just pulled in, come out and get in. And unfortunately, Danny hung himself. And because I went over, I knew that there was some people going there, some old friends. He started running around with the old friends again. And that little son of a gun went, I owned a woods there, and he went and hung himself in a tree. And I heard his mother screaming, and I went looking for her, and she was there trying to hold him up, and we cut him down. The tragedies of alcohol have been, I've seen it. I'm going to tell you some good stuff. I went to a meeting some time ago, because I sponsor people, and so there's a fellow that I sponsor, happens to be in the medical profession, and he's got to get back to his office. So we'd go to this one particular meeting periodically when he could. We'd take off and I'd go get in. We'd go to that meeting. We went to the meeting one day, and in the course of the meeting, the topic was what got you to come back and stay in AA? And I didn't know it. I didn't know the guy, the first guy to speak. He said, well, I've been sober now 20 years. And he said, 20 years ago when I was in treatment, he said, they took us to a speaker meeting, and this was in Tupelo, Mississippi. And he said, I'll never forget the speaker. He said, the speaker was just so dynamic about some of the things he said. And then he said, his name was Gary Miller. And I'll never forget that. We quietly got up and left. So those are the rewards. I've always said, you never know what influence you have on someone, and you'll never know it. Just this last week, somebody came to me and said they remembered something that I had said 10 years ago, and 10 or 11 years ago, and I don't remember that. I'm a firm believer in. And Tom taught me that if I'm kind and careful and loving and so on, respectful, those rewards, I'll never know those rewards, but they're internal, and they're internal rewards. Then talk a little bit about Tom. Tom got cancer, knew he was going to die. I used to go when he was in the hospital. I'd go see him every morning early. I'm an early riser, and I'd go over at 5 o'clock in the morning, tell him what the weather was, and talk to him. But before he got in the hospital, I took him to the doctor doctor one day, and we went to the doctor, and when we left there, he said, let's go out in the country, and we did. And he said, when you find a spot, he said, pull over and stop. And we did. And he told me goodbye. And I told him goodbye. And he called his, he had two girls in Pennsylvania. And he called them from my truck and said, come down for Christmas. That was in December. And they came down for Christmas and we had a Christmas dinner together. And then he went into the hospital. And the 27th of January, he died. But the day before he died, on a Sunday, he died on Monday morning early. And on Sunday, there were three of us that went in to see him that afternoon. Now, he could not speak a full sentence. He could just whisper. And we came in there and he motioned us over and he whispered, call in the nurse and wish her happy birthday. I'll never forget that. 12 hours later, that man was dead. And yet he was thinking about a nurse that had a birthday. Tom taught me how to live and Tom taught me how to die. Now, he passed away. We picked out my next sponsor. I didn't have a sponsor. Tom died at 4 o'clock that afternoon. I had another sponsor. And unfortunately, he died about 4 or 5 months later, unsuspectingly. He didn't have any idea he was going to die, and he did. And then I got my third sponsor. My third sponsor died here about 2 years ago. And he's a wonderful, wonderful man. He was panel 24 delegate to the General Service Conference. He was 55 years sober, still went to about 4 to 5 meetings a week, taught me real well that it's unchristian to go to an AA meeting with by yourself in a vehicle. He used to say you can tell how good a group is doing if you count the cars in the parking lot and then count the people in the median. He said, if you got the same amount of people in the median as you got cars in the parking lot, it's probably not a real healthy group. And what you need to do is get in there and try to, if you're going to go to that group, you need to try to be healthy. So I, to this day, will drive out of my way any number of miles to pick somebody up to go to a meeting. That's, in fact, currently I'm going about 15 miles out of my way to go pick somebody up and take them back home just to go to an AA meeting. I just think that's really, really vitally important. I have been over privileged to meet some icons in AA. There's folks on this meeting that talk about people like David Aronofsky. He was somebody that was just really, I used to call his office and Gracie would say, well, he's busy right now, but you hold on, Gary, because I know he wants to talk to you. And it was anything that I had the questions about service work or anything about traditions or anything about concepts, David Aronofsky would know the answer to that. And at one time I flew from Mississippi to San Antonio, Texas, to go to their Southwest Regional Forum just to sit next to David Aronofsky. He was just an icon in my life. I was one of those that I would go to a workshop. I've been to a Sherry, and they don't like the word workshop. AAs don't like the word workshop. And so I know. It's amazing they put that notice up of that sharing session they're going to have in New York. There's one from Mississippi, and it comes from New York. It actually was somebody from New York a year or so moved to South Mississippi, and they said we're going to have an all day workshop, but it's not going to be called a workshop. And so ours is called A Day of Learning. And it's and the topic is how service and communication intertwine. And that's the 18th of next month. And I've been asked to get a panel together to share at that, and it's down on the coast. And so those are the kinds of things. Today, I've always said, if you want me to come and share at your group or whatever, I tell these people this all the time, all I need is a boiled egg and a bologna sandwich, and I'll show up. Don't worry about the money. I have been rewarded so much for Alcoholics Anonymous. And I talk about it, and you know, a lot of you heard me say, I almost missed this thing. When I got into treatment, I went in there on a Monday, and I decided that Tuesday I'd overshot the deal here. I'd overreacted. So I tried to talk them into letting me get out, because this was in November, in October. And I said, I got things I got to do. So I'll come back in probably first part of February. I'll come back and go through your center here. And fortunately, they kept me there. They held me there. I can tell you story after story of people that were at that meeting that died due to alcoholism. One of the guys, in fact, I've probably financed a couple. You know, when somebody come to me and they ask me for money, I'd give them money I didn't really have, but I thought I was doing the right thing, and so I would do that. And so grateful for a sponsor that taught me. Tom taught me, in particular, he's been the biggest influence in my life. But Tom taught me that you don't worry about how the mule got in the ditch; just get him out. And don't criticize him. He used to say to me all the time, if you criticize somebody, you can be best assured that if they ever do decide they want to do something and change their lifestyle, they're not going to call you. They'll call somebody else. And he also taught me the thing, and I've said it, you can tell an alcoholic, you just can't tell him much. You need to lead him. You need to guide him. You need to direct him. You need to love him. You need to care for him. I'm going to talk just real briefly about Al-Anon and how important that is to me in my life. Tom said that I needed to go to 10 Al-Anon meetings. And he said, don't bounce around. Go to the same one and go for at least 10 meetings. He said, because everybody that you're going to deal with is going to be alcoholics. And if you're dealing with alcoholics, you need to have a way to learn how to love them and let them go. And I've done that. And I did that. Three times in my recovery, I have gone to Al-Anon for 10 meetings because of circumstances in my life. And it's been real, real important to me. I have done Al-Anon 12-step calls. One of my best friends in South Mississippi, in fact, when I go down there, I usually stay with him, is a man that I took him to Al-Anon. And that's just important stuff to me, and still is to this day. I really, really respect the Al-Anon family program. I could go on forever and ever and talk about the rewards that I've gotten in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's unbelievable, just unbelievable. I was never any good with relationships. I just had a tough time with relationships. Today I'm married, and the thing is, that's wonderful about it is I married up. I met this, met my wife. I was sober. It was in my first year of sobriety, and she's so responsible. She had a family. Her mother had a stroke, and so she moved from South Mississippi to Florida and took care of her mother. And so we didn't see each other then for several years, and then we got back together, and then we got married, and my life is absolutely fantastic, and there isn't anything special going on. Tom taught me things like, if you want to be married, act like it. If you want to be sober, act like it. So I try today to act like a sober married man, and I didn't do that for a long time. Even in sobriety, in early sobriety, I am not real pleased about my behaviors. But today, I really enjoy my behaviors. I think they're pretty reasonable, and I get up real early. I'm an early riser, and so I get up real early and get myself centered for the day. And I always, every morning I think about Tom, and I also think about Henry, my third sponsor, and how important their life is. And today I try to periodically, I don't try to overemphasize to people. I just try to be kind to people. I gather things, and I just really, really enjoy Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to close with a joke I heard that it's not original, but I like it. This guy died and he went to heaven, and he got there, and St. Peter pulled out his computer and looked and said, "Yep, you're supposed to be here. We're happy you're here." And so the guy said, "Wow, I'm sure grateful for that." He said, "Well, what religious faith were you when you were on earth?" And the guy hesitated and said, and St. Peter said, "Right, come with me. I'll just show you." So he went down the hall and he opened up a door and he looked in there. There were some people in there sitting on hardwood benches, reading small print Bibles, and somebody was preaching and somebody was teaching. And he said, "Well, who are these?" And he said, these are the Protestants, and they think this is pure joy." And so then he went down the next door, he opened it up and he looked in there, and there were some people in there. They were, some of them doing the sacraments, and some of them were praying a rosary, and some of them had beads of sweat. And he said, "Well, who are these?" And he said, "Well, these are the Catholics, and some of them don't realize they're here yet." And he said, but come on down here. I'm going to show you another room. So he opened up the room, and when he opened up the door, out come this cigarette smoke, and you could smell coffee. And they looked in there, and there was some laughing going on, and there's some heeing and sheeing, and there were some people that were sitting in a circle talking, and some people were listening to somebody else talk. And he said, "Well, who are these?" And he said, "Well, we don't know, because they won't tell. But the only thing they'll say is they're here just one day at a time. Thank you very much. Appreciate you all."